This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the evening edition with Lynn and Kelvin. Our next story, continuing our talk about wages and loans and prices and cost of living. So Prime Minister Dr. Mahathir Mohamad has recently said that pay rises lead to increased prices of goods. And of course, this has ended up inviting criticism.
He said this in a recent interview with Free Malaysia Today. He said the government was not increasing the salaries of civil servants, as that would mean the private sector too would follow suit. And with that, the cost of things will also increase. And many people were obviously unhappy with his administration for failing to lower prices despite replacing the unpopular GST with the SST just recently.
So this is one of those things where you hear it and for a second you think, really? I'm not sure how that works. And so because of that, we're crossing over to an economist, Firdaus Rosli from the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, or ISIS Malaysia. Firdaus, thanks for joining us on the program. So referring to Tun M's statement about how an increase in wages within the civil sector would then lead to an increase in prices, I mean, is that necessarily true? I mean, talk us through it.
I think, first of all, if we were to revisit the cause and effect relationship and perhaps even economic theory between rising wages and rising prices, it's safe to say that as wages rise, disposable incomes will also rise, assuming no changes in taxation interest rates, and then the demand for goods will also rise, which in turn lead to higher prices, and then it will create that cycle. So such a scenario will definitely push workers to demand higher wages, and then that's how the circular effect continues in an economy. But that's very much on the theoretical perspective, how the relationship works. But in practice, at least in the Malaysian context, the questions that we should be asking is whether or not real wages grow over the years, and even if they did, to whom and by how much. What I'm trying to say here is that I think it's probably apt for us to break it down into a more granular perspectives, which touches on quite a number of variables such as income classes, locality, ethnic groups, and perhaps even more importantly, whether wages in the private sector rose in tandem with the public sector. More often than not, you'll find that the public sector wages has increased quite steadily over the years, but not so much when it comes to the private sector. I think I also understand where the netizens are coming from as well, because many of the netizens, my assumption is that come from the private sector. They don't, perhaps, you know, in terms of increase in wages, it's not as clear-cut as how you see in a public sector. And that's where the tensions lie, I think.
Could you talk to us a bit more about how salary increases differ between the private and the civil sector?
So now, there's a difference between what the numbers are saying, between what we are feeling on the ground. So what the numbers are effectively saying is that if you were to compare the wages in the private sector and the public sector, the starting pay for the public sector is much higher compared to that of in the private sector. But as you move along, if you move up in hierarchy, you will find that there's a huge disconnect between what the private sector take-home pay is compared to the public sector. So I think there is a lot to dissect based on this alone. But we must take note that over the years, interventions such as the minimum wage, as well as the BRIM, now rebranded into Bantuan Sara Hidup, has somewhat gave the cushion or somewhat a positive effect to the B40 in general.
So back to the question then of wages and price increases, I guess it's not a clear-cut answer, as you've alluded to earlier, but it's easy to imagine how theoretically a wage increase for all civil servants would affect the purchasing power of quite a significant chunk of society, even if there are other factors that come into play.
There's quite a number of factors to consider. I mean, again, if I were to isolate the problem into the public sector for, you know, to start with. If the government, say, announce that, you know, there will be a bonus, a one-month bonus to private sector, to the public sector, then you will see that, you know, the almost immediately, about 11% of the workforce will receive that that bonus. And then that bonus will translate into spending, assuming that, you know, a large portion of that bonus will go into spending rather than savings, and also perhaps investment at a more micro level as well. So based on that alone, you will see that, you know, there is an effect there, right there alone. And if you were to look at the private sector, well, it depends on the sector that you believe that you work in. I mean, it varies really. So there's no one way for us to look at it. But generally speaking, when there's, you know, more money chasing lesser goods, then prices will go up. And as I mentioned earlier, then, you know, there'll be more demand for these goods. And when prices go up, and then, you know, workers will demand for higher wages, and then that inflationary effect will actually feed into rising in wages over time. So, you know, that's where I mentioned just now, the circular effect will continue.
I foresee that this won't be a straightforward answer as well, but between reducing prices and increasing wages, what do you think should be given more focus in terms of making the cost of living more manageable?
Well, I guess it depends on what the government intends to do, which can be two separate things, really. On the one hand, we can continue going on cost minimization policies, but that will be very much centered on substitutes. So these substitutes may not necessarily be the best ones because we're looking at costs here. So you will see that we will continue to suppress costs as the economy grows over the years. But if we were to go for a wage maximization policies, for example, then you will see that, you know, the economy will have to be adjusted gradually or perhaps even progressively so that economies of scale can continue to flourish in the economy. And this will come into different policy levers altogether. So you will have to address in terms of our position in international trade. So if there are other countries who can produce things cheaper and better, so we, you know, it makes sense for us to liberalize and allow those goods to come in a, you know, with a very less price translation, you know. And as a result of that, we have to ensure that our taxation, particularly the direct and indirect, well, indirect taxes, in our case, perhaps, you know, will address the cash transfers, the subsidies of the B40, because we have to continuously make sure that as the economy grows, the B40 is not going to be left out from the expansion of the economic pie. But the problem now, I think tensions lie very much in the M40, because the T20 can, you know, is usually, you know, okay. And the B40 is usually being addressed by the government anyway. But what about the M40? What sort of policies do we want to address as far as the M40 is concerned? And this is probably the conundrum that most countries have moving forward.
Firdaus, thanks for joining us. That was economist Firdaus Rusli from the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. You can, of course, weigh in. Do you think that pay rises also lead to corresponding increases in the price of goods and the cost of living? You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. Earlier we had we were talking about PTPTN, which is always an issue that gets people going, I think, because there are just so many issues surrounding it. And we've gotten a number of messages.
We have Rosalind Kam saying that, I'm sure many people know young graduates whose first major purchase is an iPhone or a high-end Samsung. It says a lot about their priorities.
And John says PTPTN is a loan and should be treated as such. Defaulters should not be able to get a house loan, car loan, etc. We've heard of this before. And any applicant whose parents are not paying their PTPTN should be automatically rejected. Too many are ignoring because there is simply no consequence to them. I think that's an interesting point. If you were to make it so that parents, the actions of parents would affect their children, I think in many ways it does because it's a future generation thing. But when it's your family, you really feel it.
Though, is that necessarily fair on that other party? I don't know.
On the child?
Yeah.
Well, it's not the responsibility of the child to get that sorted. It's the responsibility of the parent, I think. And so it's just a measure to understand consequence.
Right. Okay. I'm not
sure. You think that's too harsh?
I don't know how to feel about that.
I just think it would motivate perhaps a few more people. Faisal says, enforce the mandatory salary deduction if there are no records of payment made in the last 24 months. Qualify these as non-performing loanees and then enforce the mandatory salary deduction. Problem solved? I don't know, Faisal, but you could bring that up. I think that there are a lot of people looking to solve the problem.
We've got a message from Anne, who is someone who's actually repaying the PTPTN loans. The contract has been entered into between PTPTN and the student. The current mechanism should be applicable to those people who have been deliberately absconding on their obligation to pay. Why penalise those who have been paying their dues? In fact, some, like me, who have been paying more than the pre-agreed amount. Why penalise those who have been paying their dues promptly? The majority of those whom are commenting seem to be those who do not understand or did not take the loan. If we were given equal opportunity to enter public uni to do good courses and we are rich enough, we would not take the loan. Further, to give a person less than a month's notice to work out their finances is just hitting a person below the belt. Not cool, one sifle. Not cool.
So KF, who messaged earlier, said that BFM is being unfair to those who pay religiously. It's unfair to group everyone who as the same sort of people who don't want to honour their contract. It's only a bunch of people who refuse to pay. And in response to that, KF, I think we've been pretty clear that I think we're very respectful, actually, of people who do pay to PTPTN and that we think that the new, whatever it is that they come up with, does need to honour those people, does need to honour people like Anne, for example, and not further penalise them, especially if they've already been making all attempts to pay it back in good faith.
And this definitely, to us also, it feels as if it's too broad. The way they've painted this and the way they're trying to solve this issue, it's too broad. They haven't taken into consideration the people who are paying regularly.
You can keep those messages coming. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. We are going to be headed to the news. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.